It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share with you some perspectives, some thoughts, some feelings, and some hopes about the justice agenda in general and the criminal justice agenda in particular. Some of my thinking, or the thinking that is going to underpin my remarks today, actually were reflected in a visit that I made this summer to St. John's, Newfoundland. It was the 150th anniversary of the Charlottetown Constitutional Conferences. And as I was going through the exhibit, a number of things came to mind in observing the exhibit, which had a resonance for us 150 years later. I'm referring to the principles that were then being discussed with respect to the Charlottetown Accords that were to underpin an approach to, if I may use the term, constitutionalism at the time. And the first thing that struck me was the emphasis that was placed on the importance of a cooperative federalism, if you will, a principled, consultative, cooperative federalism. And I remember thinking at the time that this today is being observed more, to use that cliche, more in the breach than in the observance. The Prime Minister has not had a First Minister's Conference since 2009. The ones that he did have, only two before, dealt only with the economy. So rather than have regular prime ministerial meetings or even regular meetings of the Minister of Justice with his counterparts, whether they be on issues of health care or child care or the environment or climate change and like as general issues of concern, or whether it be on matters of federal-provincial cooperation and issues of justice, federal government has simply been missing in action. So I was struck by that first principle of the need for a cooperative, consultative, responsive federalism. The second was the emphasis that was placed on the importance of responsible government, of appreciating the notion of the government as being the trustee of the people. And I kept thinking back on the legislation that we were enacting or even discussing at the time, such as the Canada Elections Act, which effectively might disenfranchise members of the electorate from voting, that the government, in effect, was very often mocking the people with respect to the basic principle of responsible government. I will use the criminal justice agenda shortly as a case study of these very principles, these generic principles that I was observing at the 150th anniversary of the Charlottetown Conferences. The third was the importance of respect for Parliament. And I kept thinking that our entire parliamentary process that Carolyn and I are engaged in is evincing a disrespect for Parliament. This finds particular expression in the area of criminal justice. A dramatic case study of which I will soon resort to is that of the Omnibus Crime Bill, which simply did not allow for any differentiated discussion of the nine bills that were bundled together in one piece of legislation, let alone time allocation, which is a kind of another term to sanitize the notion of closure, which has become almost a common preoccupation of this government, not to allow for the deliberative discussion and debate that is warranted. A next principle, a fourth one that I found very interesting, was the emphasis placed on what was then thought of as constitutionalism, but which today we would, of course, look at in terms of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in particular. I say that because it's not always appreciated that the Charter of Rights and Freedoms really has had a revolutionary impact not only on our laws, but on our lives. We have moved from being a parliamentary democracy to being a constitutional democracy. The federal government and federal parliament, which adopted the legislation, effectively brought about a situation where the courts, who were the arbiters and what was the constitutional preoccupation before the charter of the division of powers between the federal government and the parliament and the provinces, now became the arbiters of our constitutional rights. Not because the courts have sought this power, but because we, the federal parliament, in the adoption of the Constitution Act, whose centerpiece is the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, gave them that power. And individuals and groups now are not simply targets or passive targets of legislation, constitutional legislation, as they were in the matter of the power process of legal federalism, but now are rights claimants, now can make themselves and assert constitutional questions and concerns before the courts, because the Charter has given us those rights. So the Charter effectively has brought about a revolution, not only in our laws, but in our lives. Unfortunately, the Conservatives have not only sought to marginalize the Charter, there have been no celebratory events on the occasion of the anniversary of the Charter. I recall, and I don't want and don't like to be partisan. I have to tell you that I regard myself always as being a parliamentarian first, engaged in the pursuit of the public good, engaged in the pursuit of justice for all of us, rather than there as a representative of a particular political party. But I can say that when we were in government, and Carolyn was the main exponent of this, we used to celebrate the Charter on its anniversary. I recall on the last year of our mandate in 2005, we in fact declared 2005 the year of the Charter in order to celebrate the coming into effect then of the 30th anniversary of the equality rights provision under the Charter, of the notion and principle of the Charter of equality as an organizing principle for the development not only of a just society, but a society that was compassionate and humane. And Carolyn played an important role with regard to that equality rights provision, which, of course, has within it rights, equality rights, gender equality, rights for minorities, rights for gays and lesbians, the whole gamut, really, of what equality proclaims for our country. But it is not only that the government has ignored or marginalized the Charter. That would be bad enough. It is its pattern of introducing constitutionally suspect legislation under the Charter, and thereby breaching its mandate under Section 4, for example, of the Department of Justice Act, to ensure that any legislation that is introduced must be vetted prior to its introduction to ensure that it is, in fact, compliant and comports with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But as a former federal official who has now initiated a suit against the Canadian government has demonstrated in his own evidence before the courts and otherwise, the present Conservative government has been prepared to introduce legislation if it shows a 1% adherence to the Charter. In other words, if they get a report that legislation is, in fact, arguably unconstitutional, and I can tell you that as a Minister of Justice, I made sure that the vetting of any prospective piece of legislation for compliance with the Charter was a crucial matter of procedural and substantive compliance. Now, we have learned that under the Conservative government, if the government felt that they had a 5% compliance rate, that sufficed for the introduction of legislation, which is why we've had a pattern of legislation that has not only been constitutionally suspect, but which the courts have consistently declared is unconstitutional, whether it be in the matter of the protection of Canadians imprisoned abroad, whether it be regarded with regard to safe injection sites, whether it be regarded in regard to mandatory minimums. I can go on. A series of legislative initiatives that the courts have held unconstitutional leads me to the last principle that I recalled from the Charlottetown visit, and that's the importance of protecting the independence and integrity of the judiciary. In other words, rather than the government regard what the courts were doing in declaring the legislation unconstitutional as the courts carrying out their obligations under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as entrusted to them by Parliament, they then sought to impugn the judiciary for, in fact, questioning the constitutionality of the legislation to begin with, effectively turning the constitutional process upside down, politicizing the whole approach to lawmaking, impugning the independence and integrity of the judiciary, and creating for the first time in almost Canadian history a constitutional confrontation between the government and the Supreme Court, particularly through the Nadon appointment process, whereby the government, in fact, challenged the integrity of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada for even raising the issue of the eligibility of the prospective nominee, Justice Nadon, something that, as part of a constitutional process, consultative process, the Chief Justice is in fact not only invited to do, but in fact has done before. And here you had a situation of the government impugning the integrity of the Chief Justice. I might add that while I was in Charlottetown, we had just in fact concluded a process whereby the government had rolled back the whole independence and integrity of the judicial appointment process. The last appointment of Justice Clément Gascon from the Quebec Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court, and I make no comments on the merits here of Justice Gascon. He is, in fact, a very qualified jurist whom I know and respect. I'm simply commenting on the nature of the process which itself impugned the independence and integrity of the judiciary. In fact, I suspect that most people in this room may not have even been aware of the fact that Justice Clément Gascon was appointed to the Supreme Court in this past June simply because the government, in fact, jettisoned the entire Supreme Court appointments process. They eliminated the advisory selection panel, so there was no advisory selection panel at all. They eliminated any parliamentary participation for any oversight, so there was no parliamentary participation at all. They eliminated any engaging of the public, such that the public did not even have its elementary right to know about a process that was going on. In fact, there was no Supreme Court appointment process at all, making a mockery of the Constitution and themselves impugning the respect that is warranted for the independence and integrity of the judiciary. By way of comparison, if I might add parenthetically, we had had in place an appointment process when we were in the government that, number one, published a public protocol as to who were the people that the Minister of Justice, that the government would consult for purposes of a prospective nominee. We published the criteria that we were looking for candidates for the Supreme Court, professional criteria, personal criteria, principles of diversity, and the like. We published the names of all the people with whom we had had consultations. We invited the public to even make any recommendations on their own with regard to the Supreme Court process. We set up a selection panel, unlike the one that the government subsequently set up, which it has now even jettisoned its own proposal, a selection panel which had on it several members of parliament, unlike the selection panel of the government, which I said it jettisoned, which had only MPs on it, and within it a majority of Conservative MPs, which thereby predetermined the outcome. Our advisory selection panel had only three MPs on it. We had representatives, let us say, if we take Ontario as a case study from which appointments are to be made, we had a representative of the Provincial Attorney General, a representative of the Provincial Law Society, a representative of the Canadian Judicial Council, two eminent public persons who were not necessarily jurists as part of that panel. And then came the whole question of an inclusive, participatory, consultative process and the like. I am using that only as yet another case study in which the government has jettisoned any claim to respectability with regard to protecting the independence and integrity of the judiciary. And a final thing which has gone utterly unnoticed is the manner in which the government has resorted to, increasingly, to private members' bills, in other words, bills that are introduced by members of the government. They could be introduced by members of the opposition, but introduced by members of the government, the Conservative Party, to, in effect, deflect away from any constitutional critique of the bill, because private members' bills are not subject to the requirements of constitutional compliance with the Charter, as are government bills. So in a way to avoid, if not evade, responsibility for constitutional compliance, the government has resorted to a rather unappreciated tactic of having private members' bills replace the importance of having the legislation introduced by the government itself. Let me, having given you a kind of just sort of snapshot of some of the principles of constitutionalism that are being honored in the breach and not the observance, that just came to mind when I went to the Charlottetown Constitutional Conference, principles then, looking at them 150 years later, to take now a specific look at how these violations find expression and use as a specific case study Bill C-10, the Omnibus Crime Bill. That one bill, but it's actually nine bills bundled into one omnibus bill, reflect and represent a series of problematics with respect to the criminal justice system, and as I say, provide a dramatic case study of what I would call the injustice in the criminal justice agenda. Interestingly enough, that when the government adopted the Omnibus Crime Bill in seeking to justify what it called the Safe Streets and Communities Act, the government acted in a way as if the title alone validated the legislation. That simply because the legislation was called the Safe Streets and Communities Act, therefore it deserved support by reason of its very titled purpose. And if any questions were raised or critiques that were offered about the bill, the government repeated the mantra, as it has with other bills that it has introduced in the matter of the criminal justice agenda, or more appropriately, the crime and punishment agenda. But if any questions were raised, it repeated the mantra that it had, quote, a mandate for its enactment. Yet every government, every party has a mandate. Indeed, we all have an obligation for safe streets and safe communities. The real question, the question that was never debated, but one that must and always needs to be debated, is the merits of the means chosen to bring about safe streets and safe communities. For example, we cannot adopt, any government cannot adopt unconstitutional legislation and say, quote, these measures are necessary to promote safe streets and safe communities, which is exactly what the Conservatives were claiming. Nor can one justify bad policy through the repetition of the mantra about a mandate, as the government was doing and has done with respect to each of the law and order pieces of legislation that it introduces, saying that it has a mandate from the people for the introduction of that legislation, as if the people ever had were even given the right to be consulted about the legislation, let alone to offer their views when the legislation was introduced. And I'm referring to the whole gamut of the Conservative government's justice, or as I sometimes prefer to say, injustice agenda. Simply put, any legislation that is offered with respect to the protection of safe streets and safe communities, or with the protection of any form of law and order, and we are all, regardless of party, as I said, seeking to bring about safe streets, safe communities, law and order, and the like, any legislation has to be examined on the merits. But when one looks at the Bill C-10, indeed, when one looks at the entire gamut of the Conservative government's law and order legislation, at the end of the day, and I'm going to hope to make this case, but I will now almost say to you what happens at the end of the day with this injustice agenda. At the end of the day, we end up having more crime, less justice, at greater cost, with fewer rehabilitation opportunities for offenders, with less protection and voice for the victims. The government that claims it is always acting on behalf of the victims gives less voice and protection for the victims, and ultimately less protection for society itself, which is intended to be the purpose of this legislation to begin with. So let me summarize, if I may, some of the principal defects of Bill C-10, the omnibus crime bill as a whole, as well as share with you some defects, specific defects in the legislation itself. And again, I'm using this as a case study. I could have chosen any of a series of pieces of legislation to in fact demonstrate the same defects and the same concerns and the same lack of constitutional compliance. But I'm using this legislation because it is omnibus legislation, because it had 9 bills bundled into one, and because it provides us what I would call a dramatic case study of the Conservatives' injustice agenda. I will then conclude my remarks with some reference to the lack of an international justice agenda, something that we sought to make a central component of our justice agenda. Namely, justice is not only a domestic issue, it is, as the events of recent days show, an increasingly international justice issue, that the two are interconnected, and a government has to address not only domestic justice concerns, but international justice concerns. Let me now turn to Bill C-10, as I say, I'm going to be giving you an abbreviated appreciation of the defects of the legislation. I could go on each of the defects and give a lecture on each of them itself, but I don't want to unduly bore and burden you more than I'm going to with the enunciation of these principal defects themselves. The first is the very bundling of 9 major pieces of legislation into one omnibus bill, and then imposing closure in both, not only the House of Commons itself, but imposing closure in committee deliberations, so that after the legislative deliberation was cut short in the full House through time allocation or closure, on the understanding that we would be able to, as if that would justify it, consider it more fully in committee, when we got to committee, there was no allowance for any discussion at all. In fact, every single amendment that I proposed as a justice critic for the Liberals to this legislation, some 45 amendments, every single amendment was rejected summarily without any discussion. And the entire committee deliberations were subject to time allocation and closure, along with the debate in the House. So not only did this not allow for the necessarily differentiated debate on each of the bills, but the lack of any oversight of that legislation. And this is a constitutional responsibility of parliamentarians. We have a responsibility to oversee the legislation. That was taken away from us. And in fact, this alone should have been reason enough to reject the legislation. I might add parenthetically, it was not only in the area of criminal justice that this was done. It was done in the all-important area of budget omnibus bills, so that there was a lack of appreciation of the necessary components in a, not only in the budget bill, there were some elements of the budget bill that had nothing to do with the budget that were put in the omnibus budget bill, not allowing for debate and discussion. Second, even before the legislation was tabled, there was a serious problem in this country of prison overcrowding, with some provinces already reporting a 200% prison 200% capacity in their prisons. We know that overcrowding not only leads to more crime within prisons, but more crime outside prisons. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court found that overcrowding of over 137% leads to cruel and unusual punishment. We had, before this legislation was introduced, 200% overcrowding in a number of prisons, and yet the legislation was going to result in even more overcrowding, only exacerbating the problem in Canada, both as a matter of policy and, I might add, as a matter of the Constitution. And in fact, constitutional challenges have been introduced for that reason alone. Moreover, in the legislation itself, the requirement that corrections administrators use, quote, the least restrictive measures, unquote, has been removed, generating yet another constitutional concern and another constitutional challenge before the courts. Third, as I mentioned, the Minister of Justice has an obligation and the government under which he serves or she serves has an obligation to ensure that the legislation comports with the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Yet prison overcrowding and the attending risk of cruel and unusual punishment, which would be a violation of the Charter and the Constitution, is not the only constitutional concern in Bill C-10. The expert witness testimony then and since has identified a series of constitutionally suspect provisions, including severe, excessive, disproportionate, and prejudicial mandatory minimum sentences, which in a series of court cases have already been held unconstitutional, vague and overbroad offenses, which have already been constitutionally challenged, undue and arbitrary exercise of executive discretion, which has already been constitutionally challenged, and unconstitutional pretrial detention issues evoking Section 11 concerns. In other words, there's been a series of constitutionally suspect provisions in Bill C-10, which any proper vetting of the legislation before it was introduced would have preempted. But the government did not engage in that constitutional vetting, introduced the legislation, bundled it all together, and since then, all these provisions have been challenged. Some have been held unconstitutional. And every time these provisions are challenged, it's at citizen cost, because it's the public that bears the cost of these constitutional challenges. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be constitutional challenges. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with the public bearing this. That's part of living in a constitutional democracy. I'm saying these are unnecessary constitutional challenges that could have been avoided, that the government was advised would happen, and in fact resulted because of the government's breach of its constitutional responsibilities. As well, with regard to these constitutional challenges, it taxes the courts. It taxes the courts and begins to abuse the resources of the court, again, for unnecessary purposes. Which brings me, by the way, when I asked the minister at the time, and since on other pieces of legislation, whether the minister, quote, would provide assurances that the legislation comports with the Charter of Rights and Freedom, the minister has repeated the mantra, quote, we have a mandate for this legislation, and has avoided consistently any response to the specifics of the question, such that I've had to resort to putting the questions to the government on the order paper, which is a way of getting answers when you can't otherwise get answers. And some of the answers have been rather shocking, such as, just to use one example, that with regard to the recent judicial appointment process that I mentioned about Justice Clément Gascon, the government acknowledged in the order question that I wrote that it was the Prime Minister's office, not the Minister of Justice, not the Department of Justice, but the Prime Minister's office that in fact brought about the suspension of the judicial selection panel or the parliamentary participation. In other words, a politicized agency made the determination to effectively impugn the independence and integrity of the Supreme Court appointments process. But that's just with regard to one answer to the question in the order paper. Now, a fourth concern, and again, this is to do with the criminal justice agenda alone. There remains the important question of the cost of the legislation. Not only have the costs of these nine bills yet to be disclosed, but in fact, the parliamentary budget officer at the time, Kevin Page, who sought to elicit the cost as part of his parliamentary responsibilities as an independent officer of parliament, and was rebuked by the government for even raising the question, which it was in his frame of responsibilities to do so. In fact, he was able to show that in costing one of the crime bills alone that was introduced in the previous parliament at being $5 billion alone, one of the nine bills of the legislation. And so you have a situation that whereby Canadians and parliamentarians have a right to full disclosure and accountability. The absence of this disclosure, which occurred not only in Bill C-10 but in others, really constitutes not only a denial of the public right to know, of your right to know, of your right to be able to participate in the lawmaking process, of your right to make your views known and engage in that process, but a breach of the constitutional responsibility that we as parliamentarians have to oversee the spending power and the public purse. That is one of the most important obligations that we as parliamentarians have from whatever side of the House we come. Yet we have been denied that right and, in fact, denied the right to discharge that responsibility. Fifth, there have been insufficient consultations with the provinces and territories at a time when these costs from this legislation will actually be imposed on the provinces and territories. And so you did not have any consultation with the government, by the government, with the provinces and territories, who would have the responsibility for administering the legislation, who would have the responsibility for the costs being imposed on them for the legislation. At the same time, and I'm giving you just one example, coming from my own province in Quebec, where the Quebec Minister of Justice sought to forewarn the government and the Federal Minister of Justice that the absence of youth protections in the legislation were in effect not only a repudiation of the Quebec youth protection model that had been praised internationally, but in fact were then imposing costs on Quebec for a model that it did not endorse in rejection of a model that it already had. A shocking example of a breach of federalism and constitutional dialogue that resulted in a worse piece of legislation and an affront to the provincial Minister of Justice and the like. Number six, even in its approach to deterring crime, something that all the parties want to address, the legislation both introduced new mandatory minimums while enhancing existing ones. Yet it ignored all the evidence. And I can tell you the evidence that is situated in the Department of Justice itself, let alone the evidence from international studies, let alone the evidence that came from our neighbors south of the border, that mandatory minimum penalties not only do not deter crime, but that they have a differential and discriminatory impact on vulnerable groups, be they minority groups or in particular on Aboriginal peoples. And here, if I may, and please allow me the opportunity to single out Carolyn Bennett for her incredible sustaining work in the matter of bringing justice to Aboriginal peoples, whether it be with regard to joining the calls for a national inquiry into the murdered and disappeared Aboriginal women, or in seeking, you know, justice for Aboriginal peoples, which is something that we will be defined. And I remember our first cabinet meeting under the government of Paul Martin at the time, when he said, we will be defined at the end of the day by what we do with respect to bringing justice to the most vulnerable in our country, Aboriginal peoples. This, as he put it, is the legacy issue. And I want you always to judge yourselves as to, in terms of Aboriginal peoples, are we bringing about the right policies? And he introduced at the time a whole-of-government policy. And I want to really single out Carolyn for her continuation and enlargement of that commitment during our years in opposition and during her years as chairman of issues concerning Aboriginal justice. But on this matter here of mandatory minimums, it's not only that it differentially impacts on the most vulnerable in our society. It also creates a situation of unduly circumscribing both judicial and prosecutorial discretion while prejudicing the trial process as a whole. Even U.S. conservatives, even the most right-wing conservatives in the U.S. political culture at this point, now regard the spate of mandatory minimums, to use their words, as a failed policy that causes the prison population to skyrocket while creating expensive mega-jails that have effectively become factories of crime. And further evidence of that came later after this report, after this omnibus C-10 bill was adopted under the U.S. Sentencing Commission report that was released, as well as other evidence on this matter. Seventh, and moving to a close, the government rejected all amendments, as I mentioned, proposed by the opposition. The amendments that I and others introduced intended to, quote, eliminate breaches of the Charter of Rights, check abuses of executive power, protect the rights of victims, provide for treatment rather than incarcerations of mentally ill offenders, and redress the damage of mandatory minimum offenses. But one of the most dramatic moments occurred in the committee meeting. One of the 9 bills that the government introduced as part of this omnibus package was a bill called Remedies for Victims of Terror. In fact, I had introduced that as a private member's bill and had called on the government on successive occasions in successive years to adopt the legislation as its own. It did not do that, but finally pressed by representatives of civil society, they included a bill of remedies for civil remedies for victims of terror in its legislation. And of course, I supported the bill, but the one that they introduced had certain deficiencies, so I introduced 6 amendments at committee to improve or refine the bill. The government summarily rejected the 6 amendments. I said to them, I'm only trying to improve your bill with respect to this important piece of legislation. They were all summarily rejected. Subsequent to that, these same civil society groups who had approached me to introduce the private members' bill then went to the government and said, look, those 6 amendments are actually amendments that will improve the bill. You should bring in those amendments. So the government then brought them in after they had rejected them at committee stage, at report stage. I don't want to make this technical. The main point to appreciate here is you can't bring in at report stage of debate in Parliament something that you rejected at the committee stage. And so the 6 amendments which they introduced at report stage, which were an exact replica without changing a comma, of the 6 amendments that I had introduced prior at the committee stage, which they rejected, the Speaker had to rule it out of order, and then it had to go through the whole process of going to the Senate and coming back and being reenacted, et cetera, until the final part of this one bill, of the 9 bills, was enacted with the 6 amendments, all of which could have been avoided had we had the minimal parliamentary debate for that purpose and had the government responded in a minimally nonpartisan fashion and taken amendments which, in fact, improved their bill for the purposes of the people and the good of Canada as a whole. A 9th approach was that the government did not allow for any discussion, I repeat, any discussion on the privacy concerns in the legislation. The privacy commissioner had sent a letter to the head of the Justice and Human Rights Committee. We sought to bring it up at the Justice Committee. It was rejected when we sought to bring it up. As a result, the legislation was passed without addressing at all any of the privacy concerns raised by the privacy commissioner, herself an officer of Parliament, but we were not even permitted to debate it. 10th, in the government's rush to adopt this omnibus legislation, an unwillingness to listen to any opposition amendments. There were this is just a byproduct, but it shows what happens when you don't want to listen and consult, let alone consult with the opposition. The legislation that was introduced had serious inconsistencies between the English and French versions of the legislation. All we sought to do in committee was to just point out the inconsistencies between the English and the French, just to let the English and French versions of the legislation comport one with another. The government rejected that, and so you have a piece of legislation with inconsistent reading of the language in English and French. The 11th matter here, and I've made reference to it, was the manner in which the government, in the use of the omnibus bundling of all legislation, sought not only to avoid discussion and debate, but would reply to our attempts to bring up any discussion debate with an arrogant rejoinder that, quote, the member of the opposition, and this occurred with me, it occurred with Carolyn Okuda, that the honourable member of the opposition supports criminals and not victims. You can find this in Hansard, not that Hansard is a bestseller, but in fact this was the kind of arrogant rejoinder when we tried to bring things up, that we wanted to be the party that was defending criminals and that we do not care about the victims, when it was in fact the need for the protection of the victims and the rehabilitation of the criminals that were part of the reason we were bringing up these questions to begin with. But the rejoinder was a standing abuse of Parliament and the democratic process. 12th and the final concern, this omnibus bill, as the government's whole criminal justice agenda, at the end of the day, ends up being about principles and priorities. At its core, I would say, it ends up being about values. If we spend billions of dollars on building unnecessary prisons at a time that crime continues to recede in this country, and we have the lowest level of crime that we've ever had, I know this is maybe small comfort to those who've been victims of crime. I'm speaking now just in terms of an overall appreciation of the process. If we spend billions of dollars on building mega prisons while crime is receding and put more people in prison for longer periods of time without the approaches to the prevention of crime to begin with or strategies for rehabilitation and the like, then that same money is not being used to invest in a social justice agenda, which should be part of a justice agenda, whether that social justice agenda be early learning and child care, whether it be a health care policy, whether it be seniors, whether it be social housing, whether it be, in fact, particularly so, crime prevention and the like. So given these 12 points in which I sought to summarize the Omnibus Crime Bill as a case study of the injustice agenda, at the end of the day, it would appear from the evidence that we have looked at and I've sought to share it to you, the omnibus, as a result of this Omnibus Crime Bill and the other pieces of legislation which reflect and represent the same injustice approaches and crime and punishment agenda, at the end of the day, we will have, as I said at the beginning, with this I close, regrettably, more crime, less justice, skyrocketing costs, fewer rehabilitation opportunities for offenders, less protection, and less voice for the victims, and regrettably, less protection for society as a whole. As I said in the House of Commons at the close of debate at the time, and I quote, "This is a sad day for Canadian criminal justice. It didn't have to be that way." Thank you.